Okay, welcome to another episode of the Rugby League Outsiders. My name's Craig.
And my name's Carl.
And we've got a great guest with us today, which is Richard Jones of the Brixton Bulls. Really excited to talk to him. He's also got another role, which is, just remind me what your other role is.
The chairman of the London Rugby League Foundation.
Sounds amazing. Right, we're going to get into
that. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thank you. Right, best way to start is, obviously, we're down here in London. Not a traditional heartlands for rugby league. How did rugby league end up on your radar, and what kind of brought you to be sitting on this chair today?
So for me, so I'm from Blackpool, but my dad's from Warrington.
All right.
So we used to go and watch Warrington all the time when I was a young lad. My dad had season tickets there, so we were going there for years. And then I moved down to London in 1997, and I've been living here ever since. And so I've been following rugby league that whole time. So you know, when I had the chance to get involved, I wanted to get involved.
Was it a woman that brought you to London?
No.
All right, okay.
It was a job.
That was it.
That was kind of a common theme we've had with everybody.
Sorry, it's nothing as exciting as that. It's just a job.
Broke the cycle there.
Okay, so it'd be, you know, great to just talk to us a little bit how you got aligned with Brixton Bulls. Did you play there, or you know what's?
No, so I started, I got two lads who are now 14 and 10. So when the little one, he'd been going to like little local mini rugby stuff on the park. And when he started getting to 5 or 6, we want to start taking him to a proper club. And so I started looking around. Obviously, there's loads of rugby union clubs round here, but I had a look around, and Brixton Bulls Rugby League Club was not very far away down the road. So we thought we'd go and play there. And so he'd started playing there when he was 5 or so. And so I said, well, if you're looking for any help, I'll help out. And, and we've been doing that, ever since. So, and that's worked well for us. So I've then got gradually more and more involved in the whole thing. And around the same time, I'd also been asked if I could get involved in helping the London Rugby League Foundation as well. So the London Rugby League Foundation, which used to be the London Broncos Foundation. And then when Broncos originally left Super League, that got kind of reorganized. Yeah. And I happened to know a couple of people, and they asked me if I could help out with that. So I became a trustee of that since then. So I've been doing the two things, ever since.
And Rick, we'll go on to the foundation stuff in a bit. We'll concentrate on that, on sort of Brixton to start with. Is your role, are you involved in the coaching setup of things, or
I'm effectively the head of the junior section, the minis and the junior section. So I help oversee all of those different teams. So we got teams from under sevens through to under 14s.
Right.
And then I coach the under 14s primarily, and I'll also help coach the under 12s a little bit as well. So I've been doing that. So my older lad is in the under 14s group. So I've been mainly coaching his age group as they've gone all through the years. And then my little lad who's an under 11, and he'll play in the under 12s this year. And so I'll be dragging him and a few of his mates down and helping out with that as well.
And we sort of spent the day learning about the community game within London. How many sort of teams do you sort of play against in the junior league?
So in the junior league, so the under 14s last year, I think there were 8.
Yeah.
So you got 7 teams that you're playing again. So we're playing home and away games, and then we play the semi-finals and the finals and the playoffs. So the under 14s, under 16s has stayed pretty strong. Under 12s for the last couple of years has been more like 4 or 5. But you know, you got 5 teams in there, then you got 4 teams you play home and away, then you got 8 fixtures on that. You then got your playoffs and your whatever you got after, and a couple of cup games and a nines competition or whatever. So in general, whether it's 12s or 14s or 16s, they'll end up playing, I don't know, 10, 12 competitive matches. And I think one of the things that is a big deal for us, and it does actually stand out relative to the rugby union setup, is playing proper competitive matches week in, week out in a real competition for a trophy, which I don't quite know why, but the union clubs don't seem to be doing particularly. So it is one of the big advantages that we've got. And it's, you know, so once they start playing at 14s and 16s, it's proper competitive.
Yeah.
Stuff at a pretty decent level, and people aren't mucking around.
So when you say that it doesn't seem that rugby union are doing that, so what, are their games kind of watered down? Have they got less fixtures?
They tend to have slightly less fixtures, and they tend to be in a a slightly less competitive format.
Yeah.
And then they play, then go into different leagues or whatever. But they don't seem to have quite the same intensity and regularity around that. So, you know, they've obviously decided that's the way that they want to do it. We find it works well for us, for then the high-performance players out of that. One of the attractions of them playing rugby league during the summer is playing regular competitive fixtures and then everything that flows on from that.
Well, I think kids have got to be, they've got to be playing, aren't they? Ultimately, that's what
they've got to be playing. So, you know, more than anything else, we just want them playing. So, you know, we try to run a setup where in our little kids' sessions, it's fun sessions and they're learning some skills, but more than anything else, they're just having a good time. And most of them will be coming along. Half of them never even heard of rugby at all before. They're coming along because it's round the corner and it's Andy and their mate goes and it sounds like fun and they're doing some stuff and hopefully they're picking up some skills along the way. Then under 11s, under 12s starts getting a little bit more serious and they start playing more proper competitive games. And then 12s, 14s, 16s start then having a more competitive and serious environment around the whole thing. But more than anything else, we're just trying to get them to play.
Mm. And the Brixton Bulls, obviously you haven't been involved with it since the start.
No.
What do you know about the history and what can you tell people about
the history of the club? This is the 20th anniversary.
Oh, wow.
So 2004 is when it's set up. So it's obviously a little bit before my time. So I've been involved in it for, whatever, eight, 9 years, something like that. So, and really, they had two young age group sides that started off at under eights and then went all the way through from there. And some of the people who were involved in that are still involved in the club. So Philippa, who's the president, and she runs the juniors with me as well, and she's also the chair of the London Junior League. So she's been doing it since then, just helping out. That was before she even had kids involved
I've
in it
herself.
I've
heard her name mentioned quite a few times.
So she's done a phenomenal job. A couple of other people, Wilf and Alison, Thomas Smith, who've done an amazing job from the beginning, and their lads went all the way through from under eights. Their younger lad then ended up playing for the England Community Lions at under 18s and all that kind of stuff. So they've been going for years, but they struggled to build it beyond those two young age groups that then went all the way through.
Yeah.
You know, they were struggling for places to play, playing out of the park half the time. It's jumpers for goalposts. And then it was just difficult to really build it beyond that. Then I think there were a couple of guys 8-9 years ago who had come down from university. One of the guys happened to be the Oxford University rugby league captain. He'd come from St. Helens, and there are not that many of them. He happened to move around the area, so he's like, well, let's get a men's team going as well. And so they managed to get a men's team going, which has then been hugely successful and done really, really well. Philippa's lad, who also turned 5 at the time, so she got the minis going again. I got involved a little bit just after that. And so then we built all of that from there, and then we managed Lambeth Council actually helped us out with a ground for a while, and we had a place to play, and so we managed to build up and managed to keep those year groups going through. Those young lads had then started playing for the men's, and then the big thing last year was we had another guy called Pablo who started coming along with his lad. He's an Australian guy a few years ago, and Pablo's done an amazing job and got the Masters going. The Masters has been massive. So they've now got 30, 40 guys regularly turning out doing that as well. So, you know, so all of that, there's been a lot of people over a long period of time putting a huge amount of work, but just getting more and more people playing. So, you know, so it's gone pretty well.
If you were to describe the Brixton Bulls kind of club culture or what it means to be a Brixton Bull, what would you describe it as?
More than anything else, I'd say inclusive.
Yeah, brilliant.
Number one thing is inclusive. So, you know, I think we'd have a good shout of being the most diverse rugby club in the country. I think we're 35% from minority ethnic groups. I think our breadth of income, wealth, demographics, however you want to define it, is probably the broadest that you can possibly imagine. You know, we got really wealthy areas near us. We got very deprived areas near us, and we're trying to make sure that they can all come and play. Yeah. They all come and play. They have a very welcoming environment. The membership subs are voluntary, and we just make that work. And so we just make sure that anybody and everybody can come and play.
That's incredible. That's I think that's probably one of the first clubs we've had that said memberships are voluntary.
So we say to people, you know,
that must be incredibly difficult to fund a club and keep a club going.
Yeah, it's not easy. So we've obviously got. I mean, we were held for a while because Lambeth weren't charging us for a period of time. So
yeah.
We were able to get some people to pay some subs within that, and we weren't having to pay for fees for pitch hire. So that helped. That then has ended. We are now paying kind of full pitch hire at a rugby union club, which we have a very good relationship with us, but obviously then there are costs associated with it. But you know, so we say to people, if you don't want to pay, don't pay. If you only want people who are happy to pay, who are able to pay to do that, if that's an issue, it's not a problem. We just can make sure that everybody can pay, and we try and make it work. And people, by and large, if they're able to, then they're paying. There's people not trying to scrimp away from it, which I also think speaks volumes for all of those people that they are prepared to do that.
Mm. So, I mean, is it an area for like player recruitment that you actually target some of the minority groups?
Not explicitly, but in that area, the demographic is very broad. So, I mean, our players will come from lots of different places of where they've heard of the club from. So, you know, some of them are mates of mates that we've been dragging in off the streets for a long time. Some of them will be seeing local flyers in a shop on Streatham High Street. Some of them will be, you know, I run quite a few of the local schools competitions. So we'll run the year 7, 8 and 9s for the champ schools competition in the area. I'll run the Lambeth or Southwark year 5 and 6 tag rugby competitions and things like that. And so we'll get a few people. So that is, you know, genuine, proper local primary school stuff in there. A lot of kids who are playing in the tag rugby and that, never heard of it.
Yeah.
Genuinely never heard of it. And then you come up, you know, there's some amazing athletes in there, and you just pick up the ball and run, and they're just brilliant. Now, he's not then automatically thinking, all right, well, the next thing I want to do is go and find the local rugby league club and go and do that. And so then you're trying to encourage them and support them and trying to get as many of those guys coming along as well. And then there will be local rugby union players. And so we have quite a lot of who play a bit of both. And we've been sending as many from who had never played rugby union before into local rugby union clubs. And then vice versa in the summer, they're coming back as well. And so, you know, so we actively try and build on those bridges as well. So a combination of all of those things, whether it's schools, local rugby union clubs, just flyers on the streets and just mates of mates from all over the place, that's kind of where we built the numbers from. And it does mean that within that, you get a pretty diverse group of people who are coming to play.
Rick, if we look at London Rugby League a little bit broader, take our question in that way, how do you think Community Rugby League is going in London? How do you think it's developed over the last sort of 5-10 years?
So I think it's really good, but I think it could be better.
Right.
And I think while it is very good, it is also can be slightly precarious. So it still needs help, as much help and support as it can be. So there's something like 20-odd, there's a bit over 20 clubs in the whole region, London and the South East. Some of those will range. Some of them will just have a men's team. Some of them might have a couple of teams. Some of them might have masters. Some of them will have women. Some of them will have wheelchairs. Some of them will have kids. There's not many that go all the way through from under sevens through to everything. So Brixton would be one of the more extensive in terms of coverage of that and helped with the masters last year. Elmbridge would be one of the more extensive within that. There's not many that are really going all the way through. So it's absolutely enough for whether it's in men's or women's or primaries or wheelchair or whatever it is, it's absolutely enough for really good competitions within that and a really good landscape. But were it to drop much below that, that would start being problematic. So you're not that far above critical mass in a lot of it. So the primary section, I would say, has been a particular area of concern. So if you take it back from, I don't know, mid-2000s, something like that, the RFL actually did a lot of investment, community development, helped set up a lot of the community rugby league clubs that still exist today, did a lot of schools development work. The London Broncos Foundation took on, carried on a lot of that stuff. Then even when that became the London Rugby League Foundation, for a period of time, there was still actually quite a lot of funding that did come via the RFL, and it was a particular part of the old deal with Sky, was a certain amount of funding was fed into foundations and community groups. So there was quite a lot of funding. From, I think it's 2018, a lot of that funding was just pulled. It just finished. Right. The Sky deal on that deal ended, and it was just not replaced. Since then, the number of registered primary players, as at that time there were 600 registered primary players across 14 clubs. Last year there were 60.
Wow.
And two clubs accounted for 50 of them.
Oh, right.
So at the primary level, you know, we can go out and get kids to come and play primary rugby league, and Elmbridge, to be fair to them, also do a great job of it and getting kids coming to play primary rugby league, and there's a few others who are working really hard to do it, but you're starting to run out of people to play. It starts becoming a difficult, now at the under sevens nobody's that bothered because they don't want to travel around going to play with anybody, but under nines, under 11s, it starts being an issue that you can't drop below that. You've got it's not really happening at all. So that area particularly, so I mean at the foundation we're trying to encourage more people to do it. The RFL are trying to encourage more people to do it. Our sense is that there are more of the clubs who are all trying to do it, but it's not easy. So because you used to have a setup where the RFL and the foundation effectively were funding development officers to go into a load of local schools and get in where areas where community clubs were, and then get those kids to come along and play, and then you could drive numbers through that. So the point then, they were running sessions across that would touch 8,000 kids across a couple hundred, a few hundred primary schools. That's just not able to happen anymore. So, and the extent to which the foundation exists these days is basically me and a handful of other trustees. We do an event every year to try and raise a few thousand pounds, and then we're able to give out a few, it's hundreds of pounds of grants to the clubs to try and help them, but it's now at that kind of scale.
Yeah, okay.
Rather than being able to do it on a proper level that you can really, really drive proper numbers through.
Has the Broncos region, the Super League, helped at all this year? Have you
seen? Well, I think it's helped massively. Yeah, I mean, we'll see as the season goes on, but there is a real sense of excitement about being back in the Super League. And because obviously the Broncos have been in different locations for a long period of time. And the last time that they were in Super League and they're playing out of Ealing Trailfinders, which was not a big, what you might think of as a big professional Super League stadium. There were only certain areas to sit. There weren't actually very many community clubs that were anywhere near it. So this is the first time that they've been back in Super League, first time in a long time they've been back in Super League, playing in what is actually a really, really good stadium in an area that I think is a good location. And, I think there has been a palpable sense of excitement around that and around going to the games. And hopefully we'll see a big crowd tonight. I think it's been tempered slightly by, then the IMG grade announcement comes out and you're a bit like, well, now I don't know if there's a bit of a sense of, well, we're definitely going to go and watch them this year then.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're ever going to be back in Super League after that. So we'll definitely make an effort on that. It was also tempered slightly by then what happened with the academy and the scholarship structure, which has been an important pathway for people wanting to play junior league in London. Now, I then actually think they're doing a really, really good job of putting in place replacements for that, which I think actually make a lot of sense and will work really well for the region. But, you've had those kind of two things also in the side, as well as the Broncos getting back in Super League. But the Broncos getting back into Super League is a massive deal.
Mm.
So I, you know, I've absolutely no doubt it's driving loads more just awareness and general interest, which is good for everybody involved in London Rugby League, of people being wanting to be involved in the game. So,
is there anything rugby league wise you would like to see happen in London to drive the profile up? You know, would you like to see a Magic Weekend come to London? Is there any?
I think. Firstly, I think there's loads of things. So I don't think there's no magic bullet.
No, of course,
in all
no.
of this, it's loads of things.
If so, I was to say, right, Rick, you're in, you know, in
one enterprise. What would it be?
Yeah.
I mean, again, you're going across. So you know, I think they need to do a whole load more around general media profile and awareness around, particularly more effort on the local and the London media around that, because, you know, with the best will in the world, the coverage of that and London Broncos getting back in Super League not been massive. I think you need to do more support for the London Broncos, and if you want to take an actual strategic view on that, and we can come back onto, you know, IMG and whatever and how that's helped and the couple of peculiarities around that, more support for the community clubs, more support for the actual schools competition, which has got a little bit of a foothold, but, you know, could be a really, really big deal. More support for the universities and all of that. If there's one particular thing within that, so I've always wondered about whether Magic could be work well down here. You know, I think there are other events in London that generate big crowds. People go into them because they're just an event weekend. You know, and so a good example would be the Rugby Union Sevens that they do at Twickenham. That'll have 40, 50,000 people turning out for, because they're going for a party day out.
Yeah, I'm in Avery, another one.
Yeah, and things like that. So you've got other events like that that work well here that I think potentially that's one that potentially could work well. I don't know if it's the right one or not. I don't think they've been anywhere near enough internationals in London in the last 20 years. I mean, no, so when I was a lad,
I agree.
And 1990 at Wembley, 1992 at Wembley, 1994 at Wembley, 1995 at Wembley, all against Australia. All massive.
Yeah.
Brilliant games.
I think the Aussies wanted to play at Wembley as well.
They're all 50, 60, 70,000 crowds. That is, I mean, how many times have we played Australia in London in the last 20 years? I think it's twice.
Yeah, I don't even think you can. I can't remember.
And the fact we haven't even played Australia at all in 7 years.
No, you're right. Absolutely.
It's
right.
Insane. It's so that would be my one thing of having regular big international fixture in London every year. I mean, when we have a big fixture here, you get the crowds out.
Yeah, yeah.
Emirates last year, you're getting over 40,000. It's the biggest crowds that generally turn up when the games are in London. So, and that then does get some media interest around it. You can get anybody who's interested at all to come along to those games and then build off some interest off the back of that. So,
yeah, lots of different avenues there that, you know, definitely see mileage in. But you touching on, you know, having the internationals there, I mentioned previously that one of my earliest memories was going to Wembley to watch Challenge Cup final, you know, and I think there's Aussies there that want to play at Wembley because, you know, it's just historical and it's just part of, and then also, you look at where are the majority of Aussie expats, and they're going to be here in the capital. You know what I mean? It just makes sense, but I don't understand why it's...
Yeah, I don't know how the Australian... I mean, there's obviously a big base of Australians in London. I'm never quite sure how much of that base are real rugby league.
People,
because of the mix of the people within there, you end up with a lot of rugby union people. You end up, if you're from Melbourne, then obviously AFL fans in that. Mm. So, but there's definitely a core of people in there. You know, then you've got a few clubs. So you've got your Hammersmith Hillhoist and people like that. So you've got a bunch of Australians there. You actually got a bunch of English people in there as well. So you've got a bit of a core there, but also a lot of English people in there as well. And you now got one of the only amateur teams left in the fourth round of the Challenge Cup. So it's a really big deal. So there's actually loads of things there, whether it's the Australians, whether it's the Northerners, but actually much more than anything else. There's also, I do think, in London, which I think is underappreciated, you know, they've been playing the game here for 100 years.
Yeah.
They've been professional team. So first Wembley final in 1929. They've been a professional team in London for nearly 50 years.
Yeah.
There have been periods in that time when it's played in a good location, in a good stadium, that's been there for a period of time, where it's got a competitive team, get big crowds.
Mm.
I went to watch them play Cronulla in 1997. They had 10,000 crowd there. And there are plenty of times during that when the Broncos or under whichever, whether the Harlequins or whatever it was, we're getting big crowds. So there's you know, when you go to the Emirates game, like you say, you're 40, 50,000 crowds when you're playing internationals here. We always hear that the TV figures on Sky are actually always pretty good in London. So there is a latent level of interest
there's
there.
There's depth to it, isn't there?
There's a depth to it. There's a historical legacy and heritage around it, but it is dispersed across the whole city, and it's not necessarily front of mind and your number one activity thing to do for that many people. But there's definitely a latent level of interest there that really does make me think that if you invest in that properly, strategically, over a long-term period of time, then you can get a massive, massive change out of that.
Do you think it's harmed London Broncos as a club, the fact that they have moved around so many times, the fact that they have rebranded so many times? And if so, where do you think their best base is? Do you think it's where they're based now in Wimbledon? Do you think that's where they...
I'm sure it's not helped over a long period of time moving around. It can't, can it? Because you're just not...
Because London's such a big place.
And if you look at the places that they've been to on that, it has pretty big spread on it. So that can't help over a long period of time. I'm sure there were very sensible reasons for why they did each of those moves at each of those individual periods of time. But it's obviously then, when you look at it over a long period of time, not been ideal. I do think where they are now is a brilliant spot.
Yeah.
Because I think that the stadium is a brilliant stadium. Accessibility is actually pretty good there. You've got three community clubs that are all relatively close to it. I think it's reasonably accessible for most of the others to get to as well.
Which three clubs are?
Brixton Bulls, Elmbridge Eagles and Bromley Bengals.
Right.
Are all that South London area-ish. And then, the population around there is... there's... 2 to 3 million people live within 5 miles of there. So it's not... Now, that then would bring me on to the IMG comment. So within there, you had the catchment area criteria within that. So the catchment area they're designated for is Merton Borough Council, 215,000 people. Now, the next door council... So the criteria on that were, if you're over 260,000 people, then you got into the next score. That they got an extra half a point on that. So they're at 215 on Merton. Over 260 on that. The next council along is Wandsworth, who's got 325,000 people. Now, you know how far they are from Wandsworth?
No.
10 metres. It might be 15. It depends where you draw it from, the edge of the stand.
So you found a chink in a bit of a problem there.
So to be designated on that obviously seems...
There should be an exception there, shouldn't there?
You would have thought.
Especially when you look at the likes of clubs that, Leeds, Castleford, very, very close.
Yeah, you can see why they've done it for like Wakefield, Castleford. That's your catchment area. But there isn't another.
So the fact that London is not getting a top score on however you've done the catchment area criteria seems like a slight anomaly.
Crazy.
In the system that it wouldn't be on the wit of somebody to be able to adjust for that.
That's just a lack of knowledge, do you think?
I don't know. I wouldn't want to. I'm sure they've done the best that they can do on that. But you would have thought that you could come up with something on that. I am very hopeful for where they're playing at the moment. I think it is a great spot. I think it's a great catchment area. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of broader rugby interest in the whole area. You've got rugby league interest in that area. So it's then just going to be a shame if they're not able to stay in Super League and really capitalise on that, because, it's a 9,000-10,000 seater stadium. You don't want to be 1,000 people rattling around in it. You want a good crowd in it watching top quality games and top quality players.
Rick, the children that are the kids that you work with, including your own, are they supporters of the Broncos? Are they Broncos fans, or are they?
My lads are actually.
And are you a Broncos fan?
Well, I'm from Warrington, so I've been a Warrington fan.
But are they your second?
But Broncos are obviously my second team.
Yeah.
And yes, so I when I moved to London in 97 and Broncos had just been put in the Super League at the time, I'm like super excited. So I'm coming down on a Friday night.
Exciting and, times as well for London, wasn't it?
And it was exciting times and big crowds. And I had a mate of mine who was on the fringes of the team as well. And we'd come down and watch that. And I'd be dragging people down. So I've been going to watch them ever since then. And yeah, I wouldn't say that I've been going regularly to every game, but I've been following it pretty closely. My lads would say that they are fans of it, and they're coming along and super excited. They bring the boots along and get it signed by the players at the end of the game. And the players, they're great. I don't think anybody I've ever signed anybody's boots in my life before. My lad is going, oh wow, I've got Dean Paratta's signature on me things, and I've got Ollie Leyland's giving me his tags or whatever it is.
You just mentioned some local names there. You know that your kids that are coming up, and do they look up to these? Because there's a lot of London-based players in the Broncos, isn't there?
So I think that they, I mean, below the under-12s and whatever, everyone knows.
No, but
in place, you know, I think that the older than that, they are aware. You know, and the kids who are thinking of taking it seriously, they are aware that then there is a Broncos pathway, that there is. There seems to be quite a lot of the kids who've come through playing the London Junior League, who've then gone through into the Broncos pathway, who've then gone on to play for the Broncos, they've gone on to play other Super League clubs, they've gone on to play for England.
Yeah.
And so there is a bit of an awareness around that, around the people who are interested in it. But those kids are also, a lot of them might be in the Harlequins setup, or they might be in the Saracens setup as well. So, you know, you've got to be...
Do you think that's something Broncos could capitalise on a bit more, marketing-wise?
I think they probably could. So I think that, you know, because those setups take a lot of kids in overall, and they aren't all going to go and play for Harlequins, they aren't all going to go and play for Saracens, and there's going to be some brilliant players
You could flip in and say the majority won't.
Well, the vast majority won't. You know, 99% of them won't.
But they don't just disappear. They go somewhere, don't they? So
they go, but a lot of them end up, they might not go somewhere. And so I think that there is, you know, so it's up to us at the community clubs, probably a little bit on the Broncos, of just making sure that everybody, all of those players, all know that going on the London Broncos pathway is a genuine alternative that can lead you to really, really good places, that you can be Kai Pearce-Paul, and one minute you're in, you've come out of Croydon, and then you play in community club in the London Junior League, and then you're in the Broncos setup, and then you're playing at Broncos, and then you're playing at Wigan, and then you're playing at Newcastle Knights, and you're a massive star, and you're earning good money in being a really big deal, and that is a genuine option for all of these guys, and you know, it's up to us, like I say, at the community clubs, and then up to the Broncos. In order to make sure that as many of those kids, that all of those kids know that that's a real option for doing that, and that's a genuine opportunity for them.
Rick, just cast your mind back over the years then of London Broncos. Who's been your kind of favourite players that have pulled on the shirt? The many shirts that have had.
I loved it when Henry Paul was playing here.
Yeah, quality. Yeah.
Loved it when Henry Paul was playing here. I mean, in that team, you had proper players playing that team. You had Henry Paul and you had Scott Hill and you had...
Well, this is what... I mean, I was thinking before that, you know, there was obviously a lure to bring those big players to London. You know what I mean? Because there was some big talent. Martin Afire.
So when Martin Afire were... And Martin Afire and Sean Edwards came here down in the late 90s. And they had a few young English lads who'd come through at the same time there as well. So A.D. Spencer... I don't know if you remember.
I vaguely remember the name.
So he'd come from Cambridge University and come down here, and another a mate of ours called Ian Higgins, who played half a dozen games around the same time. So they had playing them with Sean Edwards and Martin Afire in that setup then. Then mid-2000s, when you had your guys like Henry Paul, they had really good players come through. You know, when they signed Craig Gower, come off playing State of Origin in Australia and all of that. And so they've been really big players over a period of time. Now at the moment, you've now got loads of lads who've come through the junior league system, London lads come through playing community clubs who are all playing out there. You know, I really, really hope that Ollie Leyland gets a good run this year. I think he's a super lad. I was absolutely gutted for Bill that he's going to miss a year. They came and talked to our London Foundation fundraiser that an awards do that we come in November, and they were really good super lads. So, you know, I hope that there's a bunch of those London lads who've come through the system who are now going to get a proper look at Super League.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you go from playing part-time in front of 1,000 people down here, and next thing you know, you're playing in front of 15,000 people in St. Helens on live TV, and that's a big deal. So I hope that they get a really good run out of that, and that goes really well for them.
Switching lanes to Warrington.
Yeah.
What is your kind of feeling this year on Warrington's team? we can't.
Don't say the catchphrase.
I don't know. I mean, it doesn't strike me that the team is massively different this year than last year. So I wouldn't have thought it's going to really strike fear into... Yeah, I'm sure that they'll be very capable and they'll be competent and they'll win a fair number of games. It's not obvious that they've got enough real top-level quality that they're really going to be pushing at the end of the season, but
coach will have to get a shirt on, won't he?
Coach will have, well, I did wonder about that. I'm sitting there watching you going, I hope you brought your boots. Big Sam, because that can make a big difference. Yeah. So I don't know, we'll see.
Just quite topical. Obviously, we're going through this thing, early stages of Super League, loads of cards getting dished out for head-eye tackles and all this kind of stuff. Has that kind of permeated down into the... I know you've not played any games yet this year, but are you incorporating that into the community game in London and also the kids that you're working with?
Yeah, I mean, we are, I would say, you know, we've always been trying to teach tackle technique where people are getting low enough and you're hitting below the ball and around the thighs or around the stomach. I think it's reinforced that more than anything else. And, you know, you'd have a few kids who would be standing upright and grabbing people around the arms and whatever. And so you're just trying to reinforce that you know, you can't do that at all. It's just not part of it anymore. So I think that's probably the bit of practical level from a coaching level. You know, I think that the whole issue is obviously it's a massive issue. You know, I was talking at Brixton Bulls in a primary school a few months ago and questions at the end, and one lad puts his hand up and says, doesn't playing rugby give you brain damage?
Wow.
I think he was probably 9 or 10. And you're like, well, it can do under certain circumstances if you don't manage it well and manage it properly, but we're trying to put everything in place so that we are managing it well and we are treating it properly and we recognise all of the risks around that and we try and mitigate all of those risks. But, you know, there's obviously... Explaining that to a nine-year-old isn't great. Yeah. I hope you can explain it to his parents. But, you know, there's obviously a genuine issue around all of that. I mean, we'll see how it then ends up getting refereed. So I help out coaching under-11s rugby union as well. And they obviously last year brought in the tackle height being... They ended up settling on the sternum. So you have to look up the sternum and then you figure out where it was. And I think that, you know, there's no doubt that introducing that rule has generally lowered the tackle height from where it was before. Now, it's not that obvious of how strictly some games it's refereed strictly, some games it's not, but it has lowered the tackle height in general, which is probably the right thing to happen and is helpful. So I'd imagine you end up getting something similar in the rugby league setup, but obviously, you know, at the end of the day, we've got to do everything that you can do. So the days of people having a bang around the head and you're all right.
Yeah, back on.
Fella, you're back on.
Yeah.
We can't do without you. Then obviously you have to, can't do it.
Yeah. Do you think it's had any effect on rugby union and lowering the attendance numbers at the clubs?
I mean, I think that I don't know the numbers particularly. People tell me that the junior numbers in rugby union have been sliding over a period of time. I don't know if that's actually right or not, but I suspect within that then the concussion issue, I would have thought, would be one contributing factor to that. It's probably not helping, but I wouldn't know that much more than that. And I think, you know, they're dealing with it, rugby league is dealing with it, football's having to deal with it. It's a real issue and that we've got to deal with.
Well, Rick, it's been incredible talking to you. Every week we ask the guest to set a question for the oncoming guest.
Yeah, right.
Right, and they range from all different topics. The question that was set by your friend Kevin Rudd before was, can you name the seven members of the, or the seven actors in the Magnificent Seven?
Sure.
There was a follow-up question as well, so if you really struggle, we'll hit you with that.
Well, the answer...
the follow-up question's harder. Yeah.
The answer to the question is no, no. I can't. So I think I've passed that. Yeah. I'd go as far as Yul Brynner and Robert Wagner.
Probably pretty close. Right?
I get two.
Yeah.
I'm not, was Charles Bronson in that one as well? I might get three.
Charles Bronson, yeah.
I might struggle after three.
No, you know, you're just looking at me. I ain't got a bloody clue.
All right. Well, the second question: which is the only country to ban a sport, and what was the country, and what was the sport?
Well, I'm guessing it's France, and I'm guessing it's rugby league.
Greece and rugby league.
Greece and rugby league.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll go France as well. I thought France as well.
I think France did definitely tried to kick it out, didn't they?
I thought they banned it in the war.
The Nazis right. Outlawed it.
Didn't they?
I thought the Vichy government, under the control of the Nazis, banned it during the war.
I'm not sure we're going to get dragged into it, so we're going to have to look into
We never know the bloody answers. I don't know why we do it. Okay, Rick, listen, it's been an absolute privilege to chat to you today.
Thanks, guys.
To learn more about Brixton Bulls and also, you know, the stuff that you're doing in the wine community, especially the youngsters, because we all know that that's where it really counts. Yeah. And you can make a big difference. So thanks for taking some time out and chatting to us.
Rick, it's been an absolute pleasure. Brixton seem to be a club that is just doing wonderful things in the community, which is what you touched on, which sounds absolutely brilliant. Keep up the hard work.
Thank you.
And everybody else at the club that's, you know, putting so much time and dedication. And yeah, cheers for joining us.
Well, thanks, guys. And we appreciate having us on, and appreciate everything that you guys are doing as well. You know, I think, everything that we can do, the better.
Together.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Cheers.
Thank you.
That's the final whistle for this week's episode of the Rugby League Outsiders. We hope you've enjoyed it. Don't forget to follow us on social media and share this podcast with your friends. And as always, if you have a story to tell, a club to plug, or a player that deserves recognition, we want to hear from you. So until next time on the Rugby League Outsiders, take care.